it is, it's never like a sort of a music thing to do, a talent thing to do, just to adopt, but it's actually your real name. What a treat.
Yeah, it really is my name, and you know, some people do tend to pronounce it Gold, and it's sort of like, okay, well, that sounds like an artist name, so go ahead and pronounce it that way.
Barry, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you great, thanks.
Good, good. The studio has lots of dials and controls and knobs and bells and whistles. They can fix that up if it changes, so you just let us know.
Will do.
Barry, you are from Canada, so what was it like growing up in Canada?
Cold. when I look back at the way that my life has gone, it really is a pretty interesting journey. My father was a minister at the United Church of Canada, which is a fairly liberal Protestant denomination that doesn't even exist in the U.S., of course. And they had, you know, ordination of gay ministers back in the early 1980s. And so
wow.
It's a very liberal denomination. But my father was a minister, and my mother was an elementary school teacher. And we moved around a lot because my father felt like you should never get too comfortable in any one place. So I lived in a whole variety of places in Canada, in the province of Quebec, in the province of Nova Scotia. I was born in New Brunswick. And we sort of moved around a fair bit. And, you know, always, there's a part of me that always wanted to, if not be American, to get to California. From a very early age, I was just fascinated with California. And there was also, my family still lives in Canada. I have dual citizenship. I'm Canadian and American now. But there was, when I lived there, and I don't honestly know if that's still true or not, but there sort of is a national inferiority complex in Canada that, if no matter how talented you are, if you haven't done well somewhere else, they don't acknowledge you.
That's almost biblical. What's the story about never respected in your hometown?
Right. And so it's one of those things that I think from a very early age I sort of felt like I want to be somewhere where people will welcome the fact that I have ambitions and that I have goals and that I'm not afraid to go after whatever it is that I want.
Well, Barry, it's interesting to me that...
To answer more directly your question, it was great.
Yes.
I think I really benefited by having been raised in a foreign country, because even though I now am sort of the typical all-American boy, the reality is that I grew up in a country where, and I grew up in the province of Quebec mostly, where English is not the majority language, where being Protestant is the minority as opposed to being Catholic. And so I think it colored my view of the world and made me realize that even though I may feel and look and act like the majority in certain places, I am not the majority everywhere. And I think if I had been raised somewhere in the Midwest, I would have just been, you know, like every other kid in the block. And where I was a minority within a minority within a minority, and then add in the gay factor on top of it all, and it becomes even more sort of very peculiar and limited. And I think all of that combined really helped kind of make me who I am.
Interesting. Barry, you know, I've talked with so many people who've growing up, it was difficult for them to let their families know that they were gay because the conservative families, I've talked to Mormons, I've talked to Catholics, I've talked to so many people. But your father apparently was a pastor at a church that ordained gay folks in the early 80s, so it was a little different for you. Nonetheless, was it difficult to come out? What was that like?
You know, I have a really unusual story in that regard, and I realize that I'm so lucky, especially, you know, when I moved to Nashville and met so many people who were in their 30s and have still not come out to their families because it was just not going to be an option, and they knew that they weren't going to be accepted. In my case, I sort of accepted it within myself around the time that I was probably 18. And within a year or two after that, I think my parents and family started to get hints that perhaps I was gay. And honestly, what happened, my older sister was away at university, college, as we say in these states, and one of her roommates had been married to a guy who came out to her. And as she was telling my sister this story, she kept saying, "That sounds like Barry. That sounds like Barry. Oh my God, that sounds like Barry." And so apparently she called my parents and told them this whole story and said, "Do you think Barry's gay?" And my father would say, well, you know what? We'll just have a conversation at some point. And so my parents actually said, we want to have a talk with you. And, you know, they proceeded to say, you know, we love you no matter what and blah, blah, blah. And then it was, you know, they told me the story about my sister and they said, are you gay? And I said, yes, I am. And, you know, it was as simple as that. And they said, do you want to see a therapist? And I said, no, I'm very comfortable with it. And they said, okay. And that was it. Now,
wow.
You know, I mean, obviously the process takes much longer than that. My mother comes from a Pentecostal background, and even though she says that she knew that I was gay when I was a young child, the reality of accepting who I was and what that meant for the rest of my life, which at the time, you know, this was in the early 80s, and the reality is that at that time there were not the same role models that there are now. And the only things that she knew about gay life were having, you know, random casual sex with strangers all the time and never being able to settle down with anybody. And that was all that she knew.
Yeah, that's pretty much the story back in the day.
Yeah, well, exactly. As time went on, that changed, and she has met everybody that I've ever dated seriously. And, you know, I can tell my parents that, oh, yeah, I had a date last week, and it went really well. Or I can be completely open with them, and they are always happy to hear about whatever's happening in my life.
Well, Barry, you've mentioned you had an older sister. Was your family musical? You even went to the university to study music, so it seems to me you must have come from a musical family.
Right. Well, of course, having a minister for a father, there was music on my father's side. His sister, my aunt, was actually a classically trained singer. And my mother played the organ in church, and so I started singing in church from a very young age. My older sister teaches music to this day in elementary schools, and my younger sister is a singer and actress and Feldenkrais practitioner and a whole bunch of other things. So, yeah, there's music on all sides of our family. It was just completely natural to my upbringing. It was part of everything that I did at all times, and I never considered doing it for a career, honestly, until I started writing songs. And that's what turned the switch for me. And it was sort of, okay, this is the thing that is unique to me. This is my gift. This is what gives me both satisfaction and I think is why I was put here. And so that's when I made the shift. I was actually in pre-law and made a complete turn because I had so much music background outside of college. I actually just was able to switch my major to music composition and got a full scholarship to switch to the program and then graduated on top of the class because I had a strong background from everything else.
How interesting. From pre-law to Nashville. What a journey. How did you end up? Go ahead.
Well, the way it all works is so strange and so wonderful, and I am convinced that everything really does happen for a reason, and I've felt this way for such a long time, you know, and that no matter what, that even the really bad things that happen to you happen for a reason. And as soon as you can look at that and say, what can I learn from this? How can I move forward with this? That's when you learn the lesson you're supposed to learn.
Wow, that's a great outlook.
You know, and again, that's been part of my philosophy for a long time. And related to that, when I was diagnosed as being a juvenile diabetic, and I was diagnosed as an adult, but, you know, I was told that's what it was, and I mean, I didn't really know anything about it, and yet I had to learn things very quickly. And at the time, my publisher said, I don't understand how you can just sort of accept this so casually and just be moving on with everything normally. Like, why aren't you angry? Why aren't you mad? Why aren't you upset? Why aren't you something? And I sort of said, well, what would that serve? This is what it is. I have to learn to deal with it. And that's the whole point. And I'm not going to stop moving forward just because there's a little stumbling block in the way.
Well, that's a great outlook. And one does have to consider that at least it's treatable. So many diseases are not. Nonetheless, Barry, you're constantly traveling and certainly, you know, finding the right foods at a restaurant and dealing with blood sugar levels, it's got to be terribly difficult for you.
Well, you know, it is, and it continues to be a challenge. To sort of bring it back to the very specific content of this new CD, I wrote a song called Low and Going Down, which is about my blood sugar. Most people who hear the song assume that it's about depression or any number of other things, but it's actually, at the time, I had only had one blackout from a low blood sugar, which is what happens when your blood sugar is so low, and it's not that you pass out, but that basically you have no knowledge of what's going on. You're still potentially physically moving, and you can even have conversations, although I've never been in that situation, but you have no recollection of any of it because your blood sugar is so low. And this was the only time that had happened, but I remembered it so clearly because I woke up face down in a pile of laundry, which is the very first line of the song. And it was so unreal to me because I had never had it happen before and didn't even have any thought that it was ever going to happen to me. And so that was a challenge, but it ended up being fine. I explained it to my doctor. He said, yes, probably because, and there was a whole series of circumstances that seemed to make sense of why it probably had happened. And so I didn't worry about it. But to be honest, it happened again last week. And this time was different. I had been in my garage studio, and the next thing that I knew, it was 40 minutes later, and I was in my living room, and I had brought my laptop back into the house with me, but I have no recollection of that 40 minutes. And it's scary because obviously, you know, nothing happened, but I had a friend in Nashville who was, had been diabetic for much longer than I was when I was living there. And he actually had been in his car and had a blackout, drove the car into somebody's front porch, got out of the car, had a conversation with the owner of the house, got back in the car, kept on driving, and he had no recollection of any of that.
Wow. That's really an astounding thing to happen. I know that concerns you deeply because you do drive, right?
It really does, yeah. And, you know, it's one of those things where technology, though, has advanced so significantly. I now wear an insulin pump rather than taking shots, which basically means there's a tube attached to my body, which, you know, it's not a terribly attractive thing if I'm ever going to have sex again, but at this point, I know that's going to happen. But in addition to having the pump, there's a brand new technology that you can have a continuous reading of your blood glucose level through what's called a glucose sensor. So when I had the blackout last week, I didn't have a sensor in because one had just ended. They have a very limited lifespan of about 5 or 6 days. And one had just ended, and the process of getting a new one in sort of is complicated, and it was getting late at night, and I thought, I won't bother, I'll do it tomorrow. So that actually alerts me, it gives me a beep if my blood sugar is going low, so that I know before it gets to the point where I'll have a blackout. So technology is wonderful and has certainly changed dramatically even in the 18, 17 years that I've been since I was first diagnosed.
Well, Barry, I have a great nephew. I guess that would make me his great uncle, who's only a child. He's just now going to first grade, or just will begin the first grade soon, who was diagnosed as a juvenile diabetic. And they said he was too young to have an insulin pump. Apparently, you need to be a little bit older for whatever reason to be successful with that. How unusual is it to be diagnosed later in life with juvenile diabetes? It just sounds so like such a left field.
I know. Yeah, it was sort of, I thought, okay, I guess I'm a late bloomer. I don't know the figures, but I know it's relatively rare. When I went into the hospital, and my blood sugar was very high, and I had a whole list of symptoms, but I was tall and pretty skinny, and I was eating very healthily, and I was exercising regularly, and so they didn't tell me this, but they thought the likelihood was that I was a juvenile diabetic, but they didn't know for sure, and they needed to work on the assumption that perhaps I was, despite my general overall good health, that perhaps I was an early onset of type 2 diabetes, which is what most people have. And so they actually put me on the pills that would have helped for type 2 diabetes, and it made no effect whatsoever. And so they very quickly switched me in the diagnosis and said, okay, no, you are clearly a type 1 diabetic, and proceeded to give me the proper course of treatment. And for people who don't understand the difference, obviously you do since you have a great-nephew who has been diagnosed, a juvenile or type 1 diabetic is only about 5% of all diabetics. And what happens in a juvenile diabetic is that your pancreas completely stops producing insulin. And insulin is sort of like the key that unlocks your cells to absorb glucose and feed them. And so without insulin, basically you die because your body would starve itself to death. So a type 1 diabetic has to inject insulin, regardless of what you're eating or doing, to be able to survive. A type 2 diabetic, which is just regular adult diabetes, which is 95% of people, your body loses its sensitivity to the insulin that it produces. And in that case, you can, in most cases, you can control it with just exercise and change of diet. And that alone fixes it for a lot of people. In some cases, taking a pill might help you with the process, and that would improve that part of it. Or in the worst case scenario, there are type 2s who also have to inject insulin to help their body with what it's doing. I didn't know, honestly, anything about any of this. It's actually very funny. I was working at the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville, which is a famous songwriter's performance room, and I was working in the office there with the owner, Amy Gerland.
Yeah.
I had been sick for a few weeks, and I had been home for Christmas and eaten all my mother's good, nice, sweet cookies. And
Canadian food,
and I got back home, and after this, I had the flu, and I started losing weight, and I was drinking a lot of water, and I was going to the bathroom, and I had all these symptoms, and just, again, thought it was the flu. And then one day at work, Amy said, you know, Barry, that sounds to me like diabetes. And so I called the Diabetes Association in Nashville, and they faxed over a list of symptoms. And I read down, and I said, Amy, I've got all of these except irritability. And she said, Barry, all of them.
Priceless.
It was pretty funny at the time. And again, I honestly didn't know anything about it, and I know so much more about it now, and I continue to learn so much more about it because I'm living with it every single day.
I understand. Actually, I was, about 10 or 15 years ago, diagnosed to be in a, I guess, what you call type 2, and I take a pill. I even had to take insulin for a little while, but after I got lost some weight and exercised the whole deal, and now I just take a pill. And I understand, but I mean, type 2 diabetes is totally minor compared to type 1. My heart goes out to you. What a pain that is.
Well, you know, and the from my perspective, the good thing about it is that at least I'm an adult. You know, when I hear about young kids who are diagnosed, and you know, one of the things that happens is when your blood sugar is up or down, it affects your mood. And they told me very early on, you know, your friends may notice a change in your behavior before you're even aware that your blood sugar is dropping or is going low. And that is definitely true. But if you don't have any friends around and it's just yourself, sometimes, you know, I'll sort of find myself just getting into kind of a state. And I'm at the point now where I realize, okay, yeah, I need to check my blood and let's see where I'm at. Let's find out whether that's, in fact, the cause of what's going on right now. And I think about, you know, a young kid who doesn't understand anything about kind of what's happening within their own body, really, at that point of their lives. And so to have to deal with the consequences, but not to be able to understand what is making it all happen, just to me is much more difficult. And my heart goes out to any kid who's diagnosed and has to deal with it. But, again, technology has changed so dramatically. And we know so much more now than they knew 20 years ago.
But Barry, you wrote a song about it. This is just blows. I listened to the track called "Low and Going Down" earlier today, and I would it really floored me that it was a song about your blood sugar going. It just blows me.
You know what? The reality is that most people that's the song that plays first if you go to my MySpace profile. I love the song. I just think it's a great vibe, and the band was amazing on it. And very few people realize that that's what it's about. If you know that's what it's about, and you listen to the lyrics, then it makes so much more sense.
It's
really funny because it's part of the whole thing of why I did the CD. I wanted songs that really would show you who I was in every part of my life, and this is, whether I like it or not, a very large part of who I am and who I've been for the last 15 years. And so when I wrote it, I didn't know how it was going to turn out, obviously, because when you sit down and start writing a song, you don't really necessarily have any particular intention. And it just kind of came out pretty quickly, and I really, really liked it. I had asked a bunch of my family and some very close friends to listen to the work demos of all the songs that I was considering recording. And this song ranked lowest with almost everybody except for me, where it was I ranked at number one. And I said, okay, you know what? It's my album. I don't care that everybody else likes it the least. It's going. And the band, again, just turned it into this really fun track. And I'm really proud of the fact that if you know that that's what it's about, it makes even more sense, but that people are connecting to it even if they don't know that that's what it's about.
It's a wonderful song. And by the way, Barry, we're posting a link to your website in the chat room. Those of you who are not in our chat room or listening over the Internet, you can find out more about Barry at barrygold.com. That's BarryGold.com. We're also, Barry, posting links to your MySpace page and links to your YouTube video. I'd love to take a moment to play Low and Going Down for the listeners.
That seems to make sense. That would be great.
Okay. Studio, you should have a copy of Low and Going Down there in the collection that Glenn got to us for Barry this evening. So if you'd roll the track called Low and Going Down.
Woke up face down in a pile of laundry. I don't know how I even got to this place. The last thing I know I remember was heading from the bedroom. Was it hours or days? Crawling on the kitchen tile. It looks like I might be a while. I'm low and going down. Drives me crazy. It's up 1 minute, then I'm diving the next. You think by now it wouldn't faze me, but what if this is just as good as it gets? Give me something sweet and sticky, or you'll hear me tell you this. I'm low and going down. The more I need, you might notice before I know it. You might see what I can't see.
That has to be the first song I've ever heard related to this particular affliction that that it just blows me away for you to be able to actually translate that into a song. It tells me that you're a very, very creative person. I'm wondering if the Diabetes Associations might be interested in knowing about this song.
You know, it's actually funny. I thought about sending a copy off to somebody, but just haven't done it. I'm sure that anybody who is type 1 diabetic for sure would definitely relate to this song completely. And I probably need to follow up with that. If there's anybody out there listening who knows anybody, let me know or send me a message.
Barry, that particular track is taken from your CD called Knocking on Another Door. Tell us about the title of the CD and the song by the same name that's on the CD. How did that title come about?
Well, you know, once I made the decision, let me sort of back up for a second. I've been writing songs for other people for so many years, and even though I have wonderful connections and I keep getting asked to contribute things lately to movies and TV shows, I had this moment where I realized that if I was to get hit by a car tomorrow, that even though I've written probably over 1,000 songs and I'm proud of all of them, there was really very little in my catalog that somebody who had never met me could listen to and could say, that's Barry. And so I decided that I really needed to do that. And without worrying about what would happen to it after it was done, I really just wanted to have songs that I felt so personally connected to that they showed who and what I was. So having made that decision, it was an unusual thing for me because generally, when I started writing songs, I was 17 and, I had a crush on a boy who I didn't even know, but I was madly in love with him and it was all this drama and everything had to get, put into a song. And the reality is that I'm older and there isn't a whole lot of drama in my life and I don't need to put it into songs and it's just sort of a very different thing. So now I generally only am writing if I have a particular goal in mind. So it was a little unusual to sit down and to sort of say, okay, I just need to write songs that talk about who I am. And the biggest thing that I've certainly dealt with, and anybody who's an artist has certainly dealt with this, is the constant rejection and asking yourself whether you should continue, whether you shouldn't continue. I don't question it very often, but when you have a bad day and seems like everything's going wrong, you do kind of sometimes go, okay, maybe I need to do something different. But in this case, it was really just about perseverance. And so I sat down, and as I have done for most of my life, the first verse came pretty clearly, and it was, been on a mission all my life. And I really do feel that way. I felt since I was a young kid that I've had something that I'm supposed to say and something that I'm supposed to do, and it's frustrating that I thought that I was doing it, and it seemed like it wasn't achieving whatever the success was that should have gone with it. So from that point, it really just became a song about my struggling with continuing to move forward, except it's not really a struggle because there were very few times where I felt like I should stop. And so Knocking on Another Door, it was just, it's sort of that phrase of, when God closes the window, he opens it, or whatever the expression is. And it just sort of felt like, okay, you know what? I don't care. If you close another window, I'm going to come back and I'm going to knock on another door. And that's a part of being a songwriter, being a musician, being an artist, being anything that's creative at all. And I think even if it's not creative, there certainly are parts of everybody's life where you are having to always be, it feels like you're having to always knock on another door. And the second verse of the song says, I heard California call my name, which is absolutely the story of my life. And the funny thing, after I finished the song and had a bunch of things together and sent it to my family, my younger sister, when she heard this one, said, oh, my God, it's completely your life. And oh, yeah, that's the whole point. And it really is true, I heard California call my name. I wanted the ocean to wash away these blues, and all I got was sand inside my shoes. And I realized that's one of the lessons that I've learned is, it doesn't matter where you live. You are still the same person on the inside. You still have the same struggles. And it's not that, moving to California didn't change my life in the way that maybe I hoped it would. But it certainly, I mean, I have no regrets about having moved here, and I love it here. But again, you still have those constant struggles. And so it comes back to perseverance is really what the song is ultimately all about, which is sort of an overriding theme of the CD completely, but it just seemed like it was really the appropriate song to be the title track, given that it was the first song that I wrote for this project with this thought in mind.
Wonderful. Well, that's a great introduction. And the track is called Knockin' on Another Door, which is taken from the CD called Knockin' on Another Door by Barry Gold, and it was released this year. And is it available through CD Baby?
It's available through CD Baby. It's also finally available on iTunes, and Amazon.com is selling it, and I think a couple of other online realtors. There aren't a whole lot of brick-and-mortar stores that are selling it, but it's available online in a lot of places. CD Baby has the best deal, to be honest, because you can buy one copy inexpensively, and if you buy two copies, it's even cheaper. And so it's a very easy thing to do.
Wonderful. Well, Bob, if you'd go ahead and run the Knockin' on Another Door track for us, please. Knockin' on Another Door. Okay, we may have a problem at the studio with Knockin' on Another Door. That's not true.
Traveler, no compass and no map, wandering lost and wanting to come back. Yes, I have been tested and everything's gone wrong. If this day don't kill me, I guess the weight's gonna make me strong. Close that open window and I'll be back for more. Everything's different, but I feel the same. I wanted the ocean to wash away these blues. All I got was sand inside my shoes. Yes, I have been tested, and everything's gone wrong. If this day don't kill me, I guess the weight's gonna make me strong. Close that open window, and I'll be back for more. Knock, knock, knocking on another door. Born with the angels at our side. First we forget, then we're not satisfied. Running in circles, always falling flat. Judge ourselves, but don't see what we have. Yes, I have been tested, and everything's gone wrong. If this day don't kill me, I guess the waste gonna make me strong. Close that open window, and I'll be back for more.
I must tell you, I absolutely love that track. It has such a gospel feeling to it, and almost a touch of maybe a Bob Dylan twist in it. It's really very, very good. It And the organ, too, does it, the you pull together so many things from the church and from your life.
Know, and it's actually funny. I had forgotten sort of how gospel-y that sounds until it started coming on, and then I remembered. And you know, I probably ought to point out that the producer, who is a friend of mine, has a huge reputation and a huge history in the Christian and gospel music industry. He's won Dove Awards, he's won Grammy Awards, and all of it, you know, that's how he makes his living. But he is a friend and did me a favor as because he knew what I was doing and liked what I do, and he loves pop music but doesn't get a chance to produce a lot of tracks that sound as pop as they are. So he got together with basically the A-list of session musicians in Nashville, including, you know, Steve Brewster, who was Michael W. Smith and Stephen Curtis Chapman's drummer for, you know, 15 years. If you watch a Michael W. Smith video from the peak era when Michael W. Smith was on the pop charts and you watch a live concert, you'll see Steve Brewster playing the drums. And so, you know, these guys are so talented at everything, but obviously they got this immediately because it's very much with that sort of gospel touch. And yeah, it connects to my history on so many levels, and I'm you know, just thrilled with the way it all came out.
Well, I am too. I have to tell you, growing up in a small town, going to a little rural Methodist church, music like that just makes me so happy. I just love stuff. And the lyric of "If the weight don't kill me, it'll make me stronger," that's close anyway. Great lyric. Great lyric.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well,
yeah,
done.
Again, you know, I mean, there isn't a song on this CD that I am not proud of or happy about on every level. When we were finished the whole thing, I was just so happy that it turned out the way that it did. And I really, you know, felt like I had accomplished my primary purpose, which is that if I die tomorrow, you can put on this CD and at the end of it, you're going to say, that's who Barry was.
Now, Barry, I missed a detail here. Who is the producer who worked
Wayne
with on this?
Wayne Hahn is his name.
I see. That's Wayne Hahn.
Right.
I see. I get it. Yeah, great stuff. Yeah. And very Nashville. It has a great feel. You know, Glenn sent us a nice collection of your music, but there was one particular track that I just had to go out and get because it's about dogs, which are always near and dear to my heart. I have a doggie. She's a golden retriever. She was given to me, actually, by a family who couldn't keep her. She's 8 years old. And we're inseparable. We're bonded at the hip. She rides with me everywhere. She even goes into the offices I sometimes call on during the day that we work on computers.
You're lucky, and she's lucky.
I come with a dog, damn it. If you want me, you're going to take the dog. So tell us about...
I'm sort of a package deal at this point in my life as well.
Tell us about this song, Completely and Deeply and Generously, I think is the full title. What is the deal? You wrote this about your dogs. I love it.
I did. Actually, there are several songs on the CD that are all related to or connected to my life with my dogs. This song is, in a lot of ways, was the hardest song for me to write of anything on this CD, which seems strange to say, but it really is true. I've had one of my dogs, Loki, who is a yellow lab mix, since she was a puppy. And when I moved to California, after a couple of years, I bought a house, and I adopted a dog from a local shelter who didn't have a name, and he was a Rottweiler and probably Shepherd mix. And since he didn't have a name, in keeping with good Norse mythology, I called him Odin. And he just was the nicest dog in the world. But after a few years, he started to have failing health, and he was young, and it turned out that he had a heart issue, and there was really nothing they could do for him, but they put him on a variety of medications, and they basically said, you know, you'll be lucky if you get a couple of months out of this dog at this point. And that was upsetting to me, but I thought, okay, you know what, I'm just going to make the most of the time that I have, and that's fine. And he ended up surviving for almost a year and a half, and after he finally died, which was just a little over 2 years ago, I remember thinking, you know, it was, he felt so loved and yet gave me so much love that I know that that's why he was able to live as long as he did. That extra year that he got was because of love. And I felt like, okay, as many people as I've loved in my life, I've never had somebody who loved me so completely unconditionally, and I guess my parents would disagree, but that I have felt so loved unconditionally and completely. And a friend had sent me one of those email chain letters, and it used it wasn't exactly completely and deeply and generously, but it was sort of, you know, love completely and give generously and that sort of thing. And I thought, that really applies to Odin and both of my dogs. So I wanted it to be sort of a happy song about the love that a dog can give you. But as I was working on it, it just didn't come out that way. And it really ended up being about, it's not that I have regrets when he died, but that, you know, sort of that you're looking back and you think, if, you know, I wish I had known that this was, you know, that this was all the time that we were going to have. And maybe I would have done something different. I don't know that I would have, but maybe I would have. And so the song is really about unconditional love, and but not realizing it until after the fact, after it's gone.
Oh, Lord, that brings tears to my eyes and brings so many dog memories of the dogs that I've had.
Honestly, I still have a hard time just even listening to the song because it means so much to me, and I haven't performed it live. Fortunately, my shows in Vancouver and San Diego were relatively short, and I was able to say, oh, too bad, I can't get this in the set list. But the reality is that I don't know if I could pull it off live for a while. It still in a way feels raw, which is strange that it's, you know, more than 2 years later. But that's how it still feels to me.
Yeah, that's what true love is like, isn't it?
So, yeah, it really is.
Well, Bob, let's roll the track then. It's about Odin. It's a song for his dog Odin, who died in 2006 after a long illness, and it's called Completely and Deeply and Generously. Taken it well very beautifully done. And I have to point out to you and to the listeners the lyric about the smile. Many people would think we're absolutely insane, but I maintained until my last breath that dogs do smile.
Oh, absolutely. I would buddy to the ground. I'm the most nonviolent person in the world, but if they didn't agree with that, I would absolutely protest.
Well, it's beautifully done and very touching. I can see how it's difficult to listen to that from an emotional point of view, of course. And before we went into that track, you mentioned the Pride events, and you were in the Pride from San Diego and Vancouver this year. Is that right?
Yeah. It's one of those things where I was recording the CD. It wasn't even finished yet, and I thought, I'm doing this as an openly gay artist. I should just, let people on the various Pride committees know what it is that I do, and then if they happen to be interested and they want to have me, then that's great. And honestly, I really wasn't expecting any response since it wasn't finished, and I don't have any identity as a gay artist at all, because I've just been writing songs, and that, I haven't been in front of the public at all. And much to my surprise, San Diego loved it, and then Vancouver was a very interesting thing. I actually got to do two shows in Vancouver, one on the main stage at the Pride Festival, which in Vancouver is just like a big city party. It's, not a gay event where you pay to get in, and it's sort of in this little enclosed area like it is in L.A. or San Diego. When I say little enclosed area, they're huge in L.A. and San Diego. But Vancouver is a completely open to the public. It's free. So I was on the main stage there, and then the night before, there's a promoter in Vancouver who is on the entertainment committee, who decided that they really should be doing more to promote openly gay artists, music artists, in the week leading up to Pride. And so he, this year, launched a thing called Pride Concerts, where there were two shows a night in a variety of club venues around Vancouver. And so he said, look, if you're going to come up here, why don't you do an actual club set, and then you can do the main stage as well. So I got to do both of those, which was great fun. My younger sister, the singer and actress, lives there. And I actually came out in Vancouver. I was living in Montreal, and even though I, knew that I was gay, I wanted to get as far away from home as possible to just kind of come to terms with that. And so I moved to Vancouver, which was as close to California as I could get legally. And within the course of, honestly, it was a couple of weeks, just something switched in my head, and everything was fine, and I was completely comfortable with myself and didn't have any concerns about it, and that was that. So it really was wonderful to get to go back and celebrate the pride of being gay in the city where I really kind of came to terms with myself.
Well, Barry, it's interesting that you bring up the point that someone was going to promote openly gay artists, say, a week or so before the Pride. I have to tell you, we've had a number of artists who are openly gay artists who do music that is not traditional, disco dance sort of music, who've been on the show and who have talked about that at many of the Pride events, that sometimes it's hard to get booked as a paid act because it seems that they only want to put the divas on the stage. Now, please don't misunderstand. I love the divas. I used to DJ. I've had divas in the show. I love them. But have you seen a problem or a that tendency in your life about being reluctant to do not?
And I don't want to talk down about anything. But
me
I
either.
Certainly noticed.
Yeah.
I live in L.A. And at L.A. Pride this year, there was not a single gay male performer on 2 days of lineups. Not a single one. And it's not that I was, furious that I wasn't one of the ones chosen, but there are so many great gay male artists that are out there. And it's like, okay, why could you not have at least one on the lineup? And I know there are a lot of things that go into the decision-making process, but it seems like there certainly is a part of the community, and I'm sure it's all political. I don't know enough about the inner workings of who decides what and how. Although at San Diego Pride, backstage, one of the entertainment committee members came up to me and he said, "I'm so glad that you're here." He said, "I have to tell you, I had to fight for you to stay on the lineup. People kept saying, well, let's just cancel him and put this person in instead." And he said, "I had to keep fighting and saying, no, we have to keep him. It's really important that he stay on the lineup." So, you know, there are so many things that go into coming up with the lineups, and I think that sometimes, you know, I mean, I love the Divas too, but it's sort of like, okay, and you know, I'm going to use this name as an example, and I adore her, but you know, Kimberly Locke has played at the Los Angeles or the West Hollywood Gay Pride Festival the last 4 years. What has she done lately? Why? Again, she's fabulous, and I love her, so I'm not putting her in particular down. But it's sort of like, why on a lineup is she there when there are other people that are out there that could both be contributing to the community and gaining from the community in terms of visibility, in terms of awareness, in terms of any number of other things? So I think there's an issue with that. But, you know, I think also some of the Pride festivals are about making money, not really about celebrating what's gay.
Excellent, excellent way to put it. And in fact, a couple of the other male artists who've been on have said that it actually, at least the way they put it, that it comes down to asking, well, what are we proud of? We're proud that these people love us, or are we proud of our own achievements in our own community? And another thing that came up that I'll share with you too is the whole concept or idea of being paid, which is not a bad thing if you do that for a living. That many of times when a male actor, a non-dance music act, a person is, they'll tell you, no, you need to do it for free, and it's going to be great for promotion for you, but everyone else gets paid. Did you run into that too?
Right. Fortunately, I didn't run into that at all. The San Diego doesn't pay any of their acts, although I assume that Kathy Griffin got paid this year. But none of their musical acts get paid. And I was not paid for playing there. In Vancouver, on the festival stage, artists are not paid at all. It's all volunteer. But at the concerts, I was paid with a share of the door. I don't have particular experience where I was told that we're not going to pay you, but other people are going to be paid. The way they said in both cases, you know, unfortunately, we can't pay you anything, but we don't pay anybody anything. And, you know, if you are willing to contribute your time, and again, it, you know, in both cases, it was a relatively easy thing for me to do. I wasn't playing with a band. I didn't have to have, you know, pay musicians to be playing with me. In San Diego, it was just me solo with my keyboard. And so I drove down with a bunch of friends who acted as my roadies and merchandise people and everything else. And we just had a fun day. My sister lives there. I flew up. I stayed with her. I got to hang out and just, you know, again, had sort of a fun time. I did get paid for at least the Saturday night show, which was, you know, a nice thing and helped cover the cost of the whole trip.
Interesting. Well, tell us about that. You know, Glenn, our friend Glenn Rivera, who never surprises me with the talent he finds in this show. We deeply appreciate it. Has sent me a whole bunch of pictures from the San Diego Pride. That looked like a lot of fun. Were you in one of were you in part of the parade, or did you play afterwards?
I was on the main stage just a little bit, well, a few hours before Kathy Griffin. So it was on Sunday. In San Diego, unlike in most cities, the parade is actually on Saturday, but the festival runs both Saturday and Sunday in Balboa Park. And so I was on the main stage, and Kathy Griffin was the headliner that night. And so I was a few hours before her, but it was great. You know, there was a Jumbotron, and it was a beautiful day, and, you know, people were just enjoying being out, and it was a really fun time.
Yeah. Well, I know Vancouver had to be wonderful. I lived in Portland, Oregon for a number of years and visited Vancouver. It's a great place. It's just
beautiful.
It really
is, yeah. Yeah, and again, it was actually, I didn't realize that Vancouver's Pride was open and was just a big festival. I was at breakfast with my sister at a restaurant, and our waitress was, you know, a 30-something, what I would define as trailer trash, and, you know, 7.5 months pregnant with her fourth kid, as she told us. And we were getting ready to leave, and she said, "Can you believe this weather? Isn't it great? They're going to have perfect weather for the parade tomorrow. I can't wait." And so I said to my sister, "Is there some other parade going on?" And she was like, "No, it's all just about the gay pride thing." And it was just sort of like, wow, I didn't realize that the whole city just participates. But they really do. It's just a big party for the whole city.
Wow, what a difference a few miles make. Here in the United States, you have to fight the fundamentalists, the signs.
Right.
Oh, my stars. Well, you know,
I think it's wonderful that we've gotten to the point, at least in some places, where that's the case. And, you know, where whether you're straight or gay, that you can still come together to celebrate your identity, whatever that identity is. And I think it's great that we're making progress slowly but surely here as well.
Well, I must ask you about Desperate Housewives. What was it that you did with Desperate Housewives? I've died to ask this question.
Yeah, no, actually, well, and that sort of fits in with many of the things that I've done, which is both cool and really frustrating all at the same time. The music supervisors on Desperate Housewives are people that I have worked with a lot on a lot of feature films. And they called me, along with some other people, and said, we're doing a companion CD of music that's inspired by the show. And so we want songs that are sort of about each character, but also about the overall theme, and just sort of a whole variety of things, and it's going to be mostly original music, and, you know, we're not sure who the artist is going to be yet. It's going to probably be female, blah, blah, blah. So I thought, okay, you know what? This is exactly what I do. I love this show anyways. So it was a very easy thing for me to do. So I sat down and actually wrote, I think it was 6 songs, one for each character and 2 that were sort of the overall, or each main character, and 2 that were just sort of more the overall theme. And they liked the songs a lot, and then I never heard anything. And then in the end, none of the songs made it onto the CD, which was really frustrating to me because I really felt like I had nailed this one. And it was like, okay, if there's ever going to be an opportunity, this is the opportunity that I'm going to be able to finally latch on to. And when the CD came out, there were 15 songs, and only 2 of them were original. And of those 2 songs, one of them was written by the artist, and the other one was not. But so what they had portrayed to me as being an opportunity where every song was going to be original was not, in fact, what happened, and it was very frustrating to me at the time. I mean, again, looking back now, it's not. Although at the time, it was just really frustrating. It was certainly a low point for me. Okay, that's exactly what you're asking me to do, and it's not still not making it in, and I don't understand what it is that I need to be doing differently. And that was part of the whole process that I went through, where I finally said, you know what, I need to write stuff just for me. I need to record it just for me. And then when it's finished and they call me and they say they need a song, if I have something that fits what they're looking for and it's already finished, I'll turn it in. And otherwise, I'm not going to get my hopes up and wait for this opportunity. But now, having said that, we'll talk about another song on the CD that is related to the same story, and that's a song called Let Go, which was a song that I wrote for Stuart Little too. And they needed an end credit song. And if you know the movie, the movie ends with Stuart Little standing on the ground watching his bird friend fly away. And it's sort of a poignant moment because he's having to let go of this close friend and he's feeling sad, but at the same time he's also happy because she has found her freedom. And so it's sort of a very touching moment. And so I wrote this song called Let Go, which, if you know the entire screenplay and the story of the movie, again, is so perfectly written for that moment, but it also stands alone on its own merit. Well, in the end, they use the Celine Dion song, I'm Alive. And again, there are political reasons as to why that song made it into the movie in the end rather than Let Go, which, when I was looking back through all of my old songs, that was the only song, or one of the only songs of everything that I had written, that I really felt like, okay, this still really captures a part of what I believe in terms of life, and it really speaks to me and about me. And so I decided to include it in my CD, even though it had been written several years earlier. And what was interesting was my version that was for the movie was very sort of tender and sweet and melodic and pretty. Actually, if you go to my website, I have my original work demo of the song posted. If you go under older music, I think.